And that does it for The Morning Magazine. I've been your host, Hannah Lee Myers. Now it's time for a special Connections that's part of the Conference on World Affairs. Stay tuned.
Thank you, Leonard Cohen, and good morning, everybody. It's Friday, the 13th of April, 2018. I'm Roger Wendell, and this is Connections. Just a little side note here. The University of Colorado at Boulder has been sponsoring the 70th Annual Conference on World Affairs all week this week. Today is the last day, but there's still a lot going on. You can participate, join in. Just go to colorado.edu/CWA for what's happening today on the Conference on World Affairs. Again, it's the 70th edition here in Boulder. And Roger Ebert, who participated in the conference for four decades, always referred to it as the Conference on Everything Conceivable. So again, Conference on World Affairs. Related to that, in studio is my guest this morning, directly from the CWA, Susie Snyder, coordinates the global Don't Bank on the Bomb research and campaign as part of her job as the Nuclear Disarmament Program Manager for PACS in the Netherlands. Don't Bank on the Bomb is the only global report profiling the companies that produce nuclear weapons and the institutions that finance them. Susie Snyder is the president of the 2017 Nobel Peace Prize winning International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons and is a 2016 Nuclear Free Future Award laureate. Susie Snyder, welcome to KGNU.
Thanks, Roger. It's amazing to be here. And wow, you live in a great place, Boulder. This is phenomenal.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much. We love it here, and we're glad to have you here. Let's start out with some basics here, maybe back up a little bit, and tell us about PAX, and it's spelled P-A-X. The online dictionary defines the word as the kiss of peace, but tell us a little more about the organization.
That's great. Well, we're a Dutch organization, so I'm coming here from the Netherlands, so this altitude thing is a little bit overwhelming, but also quite exciting. Yeah. And PAX is a Dutch peace movement. It's the largest Dutch peace organization, and we work on a whole lot of different issues. We work with partners in 17 conflict-affected countries, and I work in the humanitarian disarmament team. And I'll tell you, I have the best colleagues. We work on everything from stopping the development of killer robots to preventing the use of explosive weapons in populated areas to identifying financial institutions that are trying to profit off of prohibited and just controversial weapons, including nuclear weapons. It's amazing. Great place to work.
We certainly have a ton of things to talk about this morning, especially nuclear weapons. But you piqued my interest here when you said killer robots. I saw that term on your website. We'll give out that web URL here in just a minute or two. But what's a killer robot? I don't think many of us are familiar with it. At least I'm not.
Well, that's fine. And it's good that you're not familiar with it because they haven't been made yet. And so what we're doing is we're working to make sure that they are not made. And what it is, it's there's a lot of robots that are currently being used in military operations, used in warfare. And they are, some of them are quite handy, like it can move supplies through mine-affected areas. And that can be, you know, a safer alternative. But the thing is, there's this kind of slight push to develop robots and develop technology that does not have any meaningful human control on whether or not to kill someone. So what we're doing is we're working to prevent that from happening. And right now, this past week at the UN in Geneva, there's been discussions, quite a bit technical discussions, about this issue of lethal autonomous weapons systems. Now, there's an amazing campaign to stop killer robots. You can go check that out. Just Google campaign to stop killer robots. And they're working to bring people's attention to this issue and to work closely with governments to say and get commitment, we will not develop technology that has a life or death control. I think that's really important. I think if you're going to kill somebody, there should be a person making that decision. It shouldn't just be left to an algorithm.
Certainly, everything's so automated. I wonder if these, and we won't dwell on the killer robot aspect too much, but is it kind of related to the autonomous cars? Unfortunately, as of late here in this country, you've killed a few pedestrians. Is it that kind of technology?
Well, it is this artificial intelligence and development of artificial intelligence. And so that can be used for good or not. And so luckily, there are thousands of scientists and a growing number of companies that are saying they will not develop lethal autonomous weapons. And I have to give a lot of credit to Google. Google has been one of the first ones to say, hey, you know, our motto is don't be evil. These killer robots might be crossing that line into evil.
Certainly.
And they're not going to jump in on that.
Certainly. Okay, for a little more background on what we're about to talk about this morning, give us some more information on ICAN, I-C-A-N, International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. How does that fit in with the United Nations and with PACs and what you're doing?
Well, ICAN started about 10 years ago, and we figured, oh, it's maybe time to bring a new look to the way we talk about nuclear weapons, the way we deal with nuclear weapons. And you can find out more on our website. It's nuclearban.org. After about 10 years, after about 5 years, we said maybe it's time to start focusing on the countries that don't have nuclear weapons that actually are willing to do stuff. And to do that, we might want to start talking about nuclear weapons differently. So the main thing that ICAN has been able to do is change the way we talk about nuclear weapons. Instead of talking about security systems or strategic deterrence or strategic stability, we talk about nuclear bombs as bombs. They're not magic. They're bombs. They kill people. And we talk about how many people they kill. This was part of popular consciousness a couple of generations ago, but has sort of fallen out of the general understanding. And through some partnerships with international organizations, with the International Committee of the Red Cross, and with key governments, we helped get a few conferences going that talked about the humanitarian impact of nuclear weapons. So there were three of those. One was in Norway, one was in Mexico, and one was in Austria. And these governments hosted, you know, 150 governments, other governments, that for the first time talked, what do nuclear bombs do? And the fact that it had been, the first one of these conferences was in 2013. Nuclear bombs are first used in 1945. It was 2013 when we first had an intergovernmental meeting talking about the effect. That's a long time to wait to talk about the effect of a weapon that has been such a big influence in our society. So we got these governments talked about the impact, and then they realized, oh, wait, if a weapon is actually this bad and no one can deal with it, the Red Cross won't go in there, Office of Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, they won't go in there, nobody's going to come to help if the weapon gets used. We better do something. And they decided, let's make them illegal. Let's set a pathway for their elimination. And last year at the UN, about 130 governments came together and negotiated a new treaty, the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. And this treaty comprehensively makes nuclear weapons illegal. And it's something that as society we maybe forgot to do. We made biological weapons illegal. We made chemical weapons illegal. We banned landmines and cluster bombs, blinding laser weapons. But we sort of forgot to do that to nuclear weapons. And now we have. And it was not every government participated. In fact, the nuclear armed governments, they didn't want to be there. And I can't blame them. You know, we're saying that what they are doing is unacceptable. And that's kind of a bit of an embarrassing situation. However, this new treaty is now setting the stage for them to be able to get rid of their weapons because the weapons are unacceptable. And we're building the norm and we're building the stigma to get to make everyone understand, yuck, And just like now, you know, we used to, I'm sure in this very studio, I understand the station is 40 years old this year. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And I bet when it started out, people would be sitting in the studio smoking cigarettes.
Exactly. Well, as best that I can remember.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, it is Boulder, but sure. I'm sure there were still smokers here. And now that is unthinkable. So we're taking that same kind of making it unthinkable approach to nuclear weapons. And it wasn't the smokers that said you can't smoke inside. But somebody had to say it. So it was 122 governments that voted on a treaty text last summer and said, nuclear weapons, unacceptable. We're going to make them unthinkable. And that's going to help the countries that have them get rid of them.
So you kind of touched on this very lightly. You said that it fell out of general consciousness. Maybe that isn't the exact word you used. And that brought to mind what I was thinking as I drove into the studio this morning, listening to the news, listening to Amy Goodman and a variety of other outlets. Although I hear a lot about Trump tweeting threats about our missiles are bigger than your missiles and all that kind of stuff, I never hear very many news outlets mention the nuclear option. I hear a lot about missiles and we're going to go to war, maybe not, maybe we will, but no mention of nukes. Is that indeed the case? Are we avoiding in the media the mention of a possible nuclear war?
Well, last summer, in August, around, I think it was the 8th or so of August, Trump tweeted out about fire and fury and raining down fire and fury on North Korea. And that was interpreted, at least in my circles, as a threat to use nuclear weapons. And that's something that is, it's generally not done because after the first use of nuclear weapons in a conflict, after the bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, it became such a horrible thing. There's a taboo. But now that taboo is starting to be pulled apart. That taboo we're worried that it's not going to hold. And so one of the great things about the treaty is it makes the use of nuclear weapons illegal. It also makes the threat of use of nuclear weapons illegal. So when the U.S. eventually signs onto it and other nuclear armed states eventually signed onto it, it means they won't be able to threaten one another with this. And that helps build trust. It helps build confidence. And it helps them feel safe to get rid of their weapons. Because right now, every time that somebody says, oh, we need newer, better, stronger nukes to be safe, especially in the U.S., the U.S. has the biggest military in the world. You know, the biggest military spending, at least. And if you need nukes here to feel safe, what is somebody in a tiny country like the Netherlands going to think? Like, you know, do we need nukes? Does Sweden? Does Switzerland? Sweden and Switzerland had programs. They got rid of them. They said, no, international law is how we'll feel safe. And that's a much more cooperative approach. And it's kind of the world we want to live in.
And unfair to your country, the Netherlands, but you do have nukes, but they aren't yours.
Yep. We've got 20 of them. They're about an hour from my house. They're American bombs, the B-61s. And now there's actually a program here in the U.S. to modernize. They call it modernized, but to give these weapons new capabilities. And that means the bombs that we have about 20, like I said, mm-hmm. That means the bombs in my neighborhood are going to come back to the U.S., have this new capabilities added, which will make them more usable so that they'll be able to change how they're the accuracy of it. And they're adding this guided tail kit. It's going to cost more than if you had made the bombs out of solid gold. To do this modernization, it's ridiculously expensive. Then they're going to try to send them back. The thing is, Dutch people don't want them. And we did a poll the Red Cross did the poll last summer and said something like 87% of Dutch people want nuclear weapons to be completely illegal. They don't want them in our country. They know they make us a target.
Right.
And, you know, they don't make us safe. But politics takes a while to catch up to people.
Exactly. We have to lead our leaders.
Yeah.
But related to the Dutch feelings on nukes, I Googled this and found that Stanford did a poll in 1945 about the American perception of having dropped the bombs on Japan And back in 1945, 85% of Americans were in favor of it. They did the same poll a couple of years ago, I think 2015 or 2016, and found that only 45% of Americans now agree with that strategy. So in your opinion, or would you feel that things are improving, that indeed Americans are preparing to lead their leaders in this regard?
I really hope so. If you look at it, the U.S. has been in conflict for quite some time, whether it was in Vietnam or in the Koreas, whether it was kind of back-ended in throughout Latin America. The U.S. has been attached to conflict for, I mean, the last 15 years in Iraq. And the use of nuclear weapons has been talked about in some circles, but there's never been a cross of that threshold. And so I think that it would be, it's such an abhorrent thing, because one bomb, if you, for example, if one small bomb dropped here on Boulder would kill 60, 70,000 people and destroy infrastructure, contaminate land and water for a while, not forever, nothing's forever, but for a while, and would leave an economic devastation that we just don't, we can't even quite conceive of, because who'd want to go to Boulder if it got nuked, you know?
Right.
That's something we don't talk about. We don't talk about the stigma of being from a place like that. I mean, the young women who grew up in Hiroshima who couldn't get married because they were from Hiroshima and lied about where they were from. We don't have that at the top of our thinking. But when we talk about how to do war, the use of nuclear weapons is not the go-to place. At least it wasn't. And I'm worried now that the authorization, the sole authorization for the use of nuclear weapons, that lies with the president. And Donald Trump has not proven himself to be reliable or stable necessarily. Yet this is a man who can choose to launch nuclear bombs. There are stories that came out when Nixon when Nixon was going through Watergate and was, I heard, drinking a bit heavily and right. wandering through the White House and saying, I can kill 70 million people, you know, with the push of a button. And he could. And so could Trump. And hopefully there's enough sane people around him who can stop that. But legally, technically, this is the situation. So it's not a good plan.
Right.
And I think that I've seen, you know, from watching from afar, people are worried. And for the first time, there was a Senate hearing in the U.S., and I think it was the Foreign Affairs Committee, that talked about the sole authority to use nuclear weapons. And it was the first time since 1976 that there was any congressional discussion whatsoever about the authority to launch nuclear bombs. And let's remember, if you launch one of these, it's most of them are missiles, and they launch, you can't call them back. Like, it's not like you can go, oops.
Right.
Didn't mean that. Sorry. No.
How does the American model compare, say, to the Chinese and the Russians? Here, apparently Donald Trump can wake up at 3 a.m. and launch a nuke. Is it similar for Putin or China, or do they have different systems in place to kind of protect from a wild man launching missiles? Do we even know?
Yeah, we do. And it's a sole authority thing in all of these countries. So Putin can launch the missiles. Xi Jinping can launch the missiles. Macron can launch the missiles. Theresa May can launch the missiles. Her missiles are on submarines. That's kind of just the way it works, because the idea is that you follow a chain of command. And so the leader of the country, the commander in chief in all of these countries, does have that authority. We've had a couple of instances where there have been, like, often the plan, the way you drill to launch nuclear weapons is you train, say, okay, a weapon's coming. We have to respond, and you do this, mm-hmm. Right? So you train. Okay, we see the weapon. We call the boss. The boss calls up the line, and then there's a 5-minute window to make the decision. Open the football, turn the keys, send the codes, launch the missiles. A couple of times, that call wasn't made. And there's a Russian fellow by the name of Stanislav Petrov,
mm-hmm.
who thought the radar indicated there were incoming U.S. missiles. This is in 83, height of the Cold War, terrifying time. Stanislav Petrov saw the missiles coming in and decided not to call the boss. He saved the world. There would have been tens of thousands of missiles sent in return. And this guy, you know, this random dude, decided not to follow orders, and he saved all of us. I don't know. There's been 1,000 near misses. They're detailed in this book, Command and Control, which if you don't want to sleep, I would highly recommend. It's been made into a film called The Bomb, and it's terrifying because we've been really, 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 really lucky up until now. But luck doesn't hold forever. And luck is not what you base foreign policy on. Luck is not what you base your security on. So we have to change. And I think that there is a growing understanding within the U.S. Congress that we need to change.
Even this Congress.
Historically, and this may surprise your listeners, Republicans are very good at disarming nuclear weapons.
And how is that?
They do more. They cut the numbers. Reagan cut numbers through negotiations with Russia. The first, George Bush, cut numbers unilaterally, got rid of thousands of nuclear weapons. 7,000 weapons came out of Europe on a unilateral decision by George Bush, Sr.
Not to question a gift, but is this because of its an economic incentive to do this?
Oh, God, yeah. Absolutely. They're really expensive. The U.S. new plans are going to cost $70,000 a minute for 30 years. Okay, I consider myself quite well off. I do not make $70,000 a year. I'm a happy person. But more than my annual salary, every minute of every day for 30 years on nuclear bombs that there's a taboo against using, like, that just sounds dumb. Yeah. So Congress is starting to have some questions about this, and that's good. Congress controls the purse strings. Congress should not authorize new nuclear weapons being built, even though that's the administration wish. It's a bad plan.
Incredibly expensive. Yeah. 8:52 is the time. You're listening to Connections. My guest this morning in studio, fresh from the Conference on World Affairs, is Susie Snyder. She coordinates the global Don't Bank on the Bomb research and campaign as part of her job as the Nuclear Disarmament Program Manager for PAX out of the Netherlands. We'll be taking calls here in just a minute at 303-442-4242. Again, Nancy's standing by to take your calls here at 303-442-4242. And Susie, we talk about the expense of the nuclear arsenal and maintaining these weapons. My assumption is it would be similar for the other countries that hold these weapons, Russia, China, and what are there, maybe 6 other countries that are involved in this?
Yeah, there's 9 countries altogether that have nuclear weapons, but the U.S. and Russia have the most. So the U.S. and Russia have them in the order of thousands, whereas everyone else has them in the hundreds. So U.S. and China have about 95%.
U.S. and Russia.
Oh, I don't know why I said China. U.S. and Russia have about 95%. China has about 300 weapons. France has about the same. The U.K. has 185. Or at least they're going down to 185. They're very transparent about their numbers. We appreciate that. I think that's really important to know how many there are so that we know when they get rid of them.
Well, this is a good point, though. Do we actually know how many the U.S., Russia, and China have? They're less transparent, apparently, than the U.K.
Yeah, the U.S. I'll give a lot of credit to the U.S., is quite transparent about its information. And the U.S. and Russia, under the most recent START agreement, Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, they have to make their numbers public, which is really important to declare this. So at the end of every year, they declare this. And there's a great guy in Washington. His name's Hans Christensen. And he works with this other great dude, Robert Norris. And they publish the numbers. Who has what? And they have their fingers trickle everywhere. I don't know how they get all the information that they do, but they do. And their numbers have been verified by governments time and time again. You can find their information on the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. It's called the Nuclear Notebook. And so I just want to give a shout out to these guys for their incredible research that does make our work a lot easier.
I don't want to drag you through a lot of statistics, though, is there a lot of meaning in the actual number of missiles? Is there maybe a better comparison as far as explosive power or multiple warheads? Or I'm not even sure what I'm asking. But other than, is it very significant that Russia, according to your website, I believe has 6,800 warheads and America has 7,000?
Yeah, well, that's the reason that those numbers are important is because that's what you count when you count the reductions. But you're right. The explosive power is quite an important thing to think about as well. And if you think about it, one nuclear bomb has 200 times the explosive power. Like a small nuclear bomb, like the kind dropped on Hiroshima, has the same explosive power as 200 times the entire firepower used in the Second World War. So the Second World War killed, 11 million people, something like that, all told.
Right.
And so one nuke... couple hundred times the explosive power of a war that killed 11 million people. So that's another way to look at it. It's a way that I sometimes have a hard time with because it's very uncomfortable. I mean, it's morning. I'm sorry to your listeners who are driving along or eating breakfast and hearing about nukes at breakfast. But it's also Friday the 13th. So why not talk about a little bit of a horror show? And that's what the use of nuclear weapons would be a horror show. You can look at it as explosive power, and it's hard to be tangible to people, and that's one of the challenges I think we've had with talking about nuclear weapons for decades. We're trying to get rid of them. Is how do you connect? You know, what makes it matter?
Right.
And so here, I was thinking about, I'm coming to Colorado. Colorado had a really significant part in making the existing nuclear arsenal, the Rocky Flats.
Rocky Flats, indeed. Yeah, the station was intimately involved in that, in the protests and the encirclements and those kinds of things. I'm losing track of time, 30 years ago, roughly. Yeah.
About that. And it's and under the treaty, the new treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons, the activities that were conducted at Rocky Flats would be illegal. Right. So it's a way to also prevent new nuclear weapons development. And I know that the folks who are here at Rocky Flats, I've been fortunate enough to meet people from the Rocky Mountain Peace and Justice Center who continue to bring attention to the issue of Rocky Flats. I think they have an event coming up at the Boulder Library April 26th, April 28th through that weekend.
Right.
They've got a bunch of events going, and it's important to find ways to connect to this issue, because when you ask people, are nuclear weapons a good idea or a bad idea? I've met three or four people outside of governments who say, oh, maybe they're okay. But for the most part, people say, no. They don't sound like a good plan. And so now I just have to get that don't sound like a good plan to let's do something about it and get rid of them. And I think we can.
Exactly. 8:58 is the time. You're listening to KGNU Denver, KGNU Boulder, 88.5 FM and 1390 AM. This is Connections. My guest is Susie Snyder, and she coordinates the global Don't Bank on the Bomb research and campaign. We have some open lines at 303-442-4242, but Mike's been waiting a long time. Mike, good morning. You're on Connections.
I like Susie's sense of humor. I forgot that it was Friday the 13th, but I listen to KGNU fairly regularly in this program. There's nothing funny about it. Several countries that she left out on the nuclear list were Pakistan and India, and also, of course, Israel, which doesn't own up to it, but they have them. And the other thing, too, that hasn't been discussed yet, although I'm sure she's familiar with all of this, is the idea that Carl Sagan first broached many, many years ago when he was alive, the concept of nuclear winter. And that would mean even a very small war, say between Pakistan and India, nuclear war that went nuke, would put enough debris into the upper stratosphere to basically, for a period of many years, possibly, definitely number of growing seasons, to devastate, agriculture and basically human civilization as we know it. So it doesn't take, this is why the concept of completely banning them is the only way to go. It doesn't take a huge exchange, as was threatened throughout the 1980s and stuff, 70s, 60s, to destroy the planet. It just takes actors like possibly, God forbid, our own president to, you know, to do something like this with a small country like, you know, Korea or whatever, and that could devastate the world. It doesn't take everything. But the thing is that this chain of command stuff, this is where, by the mercy of God, are you still there?
Yes, we're here.
Yeah, by the mercy of God, you still have people that do have their own brains. And I remember seeing on Larry King's talk show, the talk show host Larry King Live, many years ago, it was probably in the 80s, and he interviewed a retired admiral, three- or four-star admiral at the time, but he was fully retired. And he asked the admiral about the use of nuclear weapons. This guy, you know, commanded a nuclear submarine, you know, a big one. And I forgot the guy's name, but I was really impressed with what he said. Larry said, well, if you had been ordered to launch nuclear weapons, would you have done so? He said, oh, God, no, never. He said, you mean you would have refused a direct order? He said, of course. He said, the general public has no concept of the destructive power of a hydrogen bomb. The only people that have actually been around, he said, there's no way that I would have ever done it. And of course I didn't say so, or I would have lost my command, but no. And so I just want to get off the line here, but thank you for this discussion. This stuff, I'm in my mid-60s, and I remember taking tests, you know, what do you do in elementary school? They had us crawl under our wooden desks in the 1950s. And,
even the 60s when I was a kid, yep.
Yeah.
Crawling under our desks.
And yeah. But when you get older, it's like, this is ridiculous. And the last thing I'll say is this. I had an uncle who served in World War II, and I believe the casualties in World War II were more like 20 million, not 11 million, but, you know, who's counting, right? But basically, I remember asking him, because you get afraid, you get anxious about nuclear war. I mean, God, as a little kid, you're thinking about, I wonder if they nuke us today. You know, it's... And I remember asking my uncle, his name was Nilo, he was from Finland, actually, and I said, you know, what will you do if there's a nuclear war, Uncle Nilo? And he said, well, I'll just run right out into it. He said, you'd never want to survive something like that. So keep up the conversation, have more of these, and thank you.
All right, Mike. Mike, thanks for your contribution.
Yeah, thanks so much, Mike. It's really important. It's good that you recall that that famine study. It's a really impressive study done by some folks with the Physicians for Social Responsibility. And what they did was they looked at if there was a conflict, a small exchange, right, 100 nuclear bombs between India and Pakistan, and if it targeted cities. And they figured out through climate modeling and looking at kind of past experience of what happens when volcanoes put soot and smoke into the atmosphere, that it would create a summer of darkness or longer, and it would probably cause famine for about 2 billion people, and that's 100 nuclear bombs. So it's not that much, and it is, we're talking about two countries, India and Pakistan, who are constantly in conflict. They have been for, well, since partition. This is not an unrealistic scenario. Luckily, they have been working to build some trust and confidence and put in some red lines. So they make some phone calls in case they are suspected of going to that level of use of nuclear weapons. And they don't want to do that. However, it is a possibility. And we haven't talked so much about the accident risks, but that's also something quite significant. Also, Mike mentioned the work that Carl Sagan did around nuclear winter. And there's a professor here at the University of Colorado who has done similar work and who also worked with Sagan at the time. His name is Brian Toon. And he is brilliant. He's also super approachable, really nice. And, you know, when you talk to people who study nuclear winter and do the models to figure out, you know, what's going to happen and how can we annihilate our civilization, you know, you expect them to be a little bit standoffish or gruff, but not Brian. Brian's super cool and very approachable. And if you ever have time to have him on your show to answer questions about
this.
I would recommend it. Sorry, Brian, if you're listening and I just volunteered you. but it's well worth it because sometimes it's hard to understand the science of this. And yet understanding the science is how we have the evidence to act.
Interesting. I have a basic understanding of this, especially in nuclear winter, but it's in the most recent years, it's been mocked. They go back and forth because a certain side of our politics doesn't believe in global warming and will mock the nuclear winter issue that Carl Sagan brought up years ago. But it makes perfect sense. I mean, if you're going to put a cloud all the way around the planet, certainly something bad is going to happen. And that takes me to the ICANN website, where they say that 0.1% of the explosive yield of the current global nuclear arsenal can bring about devastating agricultural collapse and widespread famine, like you mentioned. But they're talking about 0.1% of the current nuclear arsenal could pretty much wipe most of us out.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. That's, yeah. Yes.
Yes.
Let's stop that before it happens. Let's talk about, maybe it would be good to talk about how people can help stop that. Because I don't want to, you know, go Friday the 13th in horror movie without offering some positives and offer some solutions. We have people who are interested in this can find more information on our website, nuclearban.org. And if you really want to do something and you feel like you have to absolutely do something today, and I get this way when I learn about terrible things, I would recommend people go and talk to their bank or talk to their pension fund.
And we are going to talk about that, but yeah. I want to back up just for a little bit, and we'll take calls here in just a moment. We've got a couple open lines at 303-442-4242. I like the idea of this optimistic solution kind of thing, but backing up a little bit, because you alluded to the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. So before we get into the good part, tell us about the bad part, the doomsday clock, and where we're at now.
Yeah, so the doomsday clock is this sort of visual representation of how close we are to the end of life as we know it, to doomsday. And it is closer to midnight than it has been since the Cuban Missile Crisis.
And how close to midnight was it then?
It was, I think, 2 minutes.
So that's
midnight.
Where we're at today, as of February.
Yeah. And this clock, it's used to be just about the risks of nuclear war and the risk of nuclear annihilation. And now they've expanded the doomsday clock a little bit more to look at other doomsday scenarios. So it also considers climate change and other existential threats. But nuclear weapons are quite a big part of it. So these issues, this fire and fury that we're seeing, right, these threats of fire and fury, are part of the reason the doomsday clock has moved closer to midnight. But when world leaders that have the command of nuclear arsenals take to Twitter to threaten to annihilate the leadership and to decimate a country, we need to be worried and we need to do everything we can to stop them. And that means in countries like mine, we immediately started meeting with our Ministry of Foreign Affairs, with members of parliament, to say, this is unacceptable. We cannot allow this. If we are a good ally to the United States, if we are a friend, we do not let our friends run rampant with nuclear threats. It's like you don't let your friend drive drunk. You know, this is this, take driving drunk to an existential level.
Do you feel that people of your country, Netherlands, and Europe in general, do they feel a little bit held hostage in that the Russians have got them, so the Americans have got to have them? Is there a bit of that sensibility?
There is a bit. And on the right wing, you know, everyone's got a right wing.
Right.
And on and on the right wing, it is definitely a, hey, look at what Russia did in the Crimea. Like, look, they invaded another country and seized land by force. Something that we have not found acceptable in almost 100 years since the Kellogg-Briand Pact. Like, you know, we tried to outlaw war, and this is the specific thing that we said we'd outlaw, as seizing land by force. And it has rarely happened. And yet the international community's response to Russian activities in the Krim was not so strong. So there's a question, and amongst the right wing saying, well, of course they got away with it because they have nuclear weapons. So we need to have nuclear weapons, too. And for me, I always come back and say, does that mean that we, as, you know, the Dutch government is going to go and seize new land by force and be protected by, you know, the American bombs that our pilots are trained to drop? So no, we're not going to seize new land by force. Like, Okay, so what exactly are we talking about? Are we going to use those bombs? Well, no. We can't do that. That would be horrifying. And the planes that we have, you know, they don't actually reach outside of NATO airspace anyway once they're armed with nuclear weapons. So we'd be bombing Germany. And the Germans kind of save our economy. So we can't do that. So why do we need them? Because they have them. And it's just, you start picking across, there's no actual logic to this. And I think one of the difficulties is that with some few exceptions, the media doesn't ask the deep questions and just says, it's the status quo. And it's the status quo. This is the way it has been. So it must be okay. We don't need to, if somebody's representing the status quo, we don't need to ask them to defend that. We need to defend new ideas, not the ideas that keep the same system in place.
Right.
And that goes across a whole lot of social movements. And I think one of the great things I'm seeing is people are starting to ask a little bit more and starting to say, wait a minute, maybe the system we have is not the best. Maybe we can and should examine it, do a little reflection, make some changes. New laws are not a bad idea. New laws help things.
Certainly.
They make society better. Like, regulation is good. Regulation levels the economic playing field. Like, it stimulates development in good ways, helpful ways that make our lives better. And I worry that, you know, you talked about those who reject the science of climate change.
Right, right.
Yeah. Well, I worry that those who reject science are you can't. Science is what got us here. Science is what means that, you know, we can live in this world a little bit more easily. We can drive cars that consume significantly less fuel because of science. Science is good, and science has, for the most part, been used to better our society. Think about, you know, do you know people that have polio?
No, of course not. Not
right.
At this time.
Yeah, science.
Well, I'm embarrassed to tell you, I've lived in this country my entire life, and for reasons even unknown to me, a native, we're losing respect for science as we speak. People are combating it. There's going to be a march for science this next weekend here in Denver and things like that. But amazingly, science is... But that's a whole other program.
It is a whole other subject.
And I promise you, we're going to talk about the things that we can do and that should be done. But let's go back to the phones, because Bill has been waiting forever. Bill, good morning. You're on Connections.
Hello? Are you
hello.
There?
Hello. We are here, Bill. Good morning.
Hi. Hey. So I am in no way in support of, you know, small despotic dictators. But when you look at what happened to people like Gaddafi, who was urged, pressured not to develop nuclear weapons and was taken out by Western democracies, it's sort of hard to, I guess it's easy to understand why other small despotic dictators like Kim Jong-un developed them. It seems like more of a problem on our end that they don't trust us to take them out when it seems like almost a legitimate defense mechanism. So just wanted to get your views on that.
Thanks. Thanks, Bill. That's a really good point. And one of the things, I saw a news story yesterday that it looks like John Bolton likes the Libya model for dealing with North Korea. It's not necessarily a good model. And Libya was under a lot of internal strife at the time that the Gaddafi regime, if you will, was removed. The thing is, the U.S., the U.S., the U.K., France, China, and Russia all have legally obligated themselves to negotiate the elimination of their nuclear arsenals. They committed to do that in law. It's part of the U.S. national law to negotiate the elimination of its nuclear arsenal, to go to zero, and these other countries with them. When countries like North Korea hear the U.S. say it can't do that because it needs nuclear weapons for its security, when the country that spends the most money than the next 40 combined on its military needs nuclear weapons for its security, well, gee, nuclear weapons sound like a great idea. Everyone should have them for their security. Like, can you blame them? When France says, France, part of the NATO alliance, backed with these other 28 countries, 29 of them now altogether, say, we need nuclear weapons because that's what gives us legitimacy in the world, in world politics. Well, gee, you know, I want to be legitimate in world politics. I know, I'll get nuclear weapons. Seem like the way into the club. When India says, you know, we're going to develop nuclear weapons and we will no longer be eunuchs on the world stage, and then 20 years later gets a deal for nuclear technology, despite having nuclear weapons, the relations are normalized with India. Well, gee, that doesn't sound too bad. So think about the incentive that we're giving to other countries, to small despotic dictators, to be legitimate actors through the pathway that we are saying is so important and is such a viable pathway. This didn't happen with Iraq. Iraq wanted to have a nuclear weapons program, and there were inspectors going in to try to stop that from happening. And before the inspectors were finished 15 years ago, the U.S. and some of its allies, but not all of its traditional allies, decided to go in and end both the regime and the nuclear weapons program by force. So that's not really a good way to go for a country like the U.S. As you see, we're still very much entangled in that, and the Iraqi people are suffering due to that intervention. However, there's dealing with those with nuclear weapons ambitions by force tends to leave these vacuums, these power vacuums, that open the door to terrorist groups to come in, that open the door for more extremists, for more violence, and don't lead to stable institutions, to what we have projected as our values around the world, which is, you know, democratic institutions. It's the opposite. And we also consistently undermine those institutions that we have worked so hard to create. Like when the UN can't agree to allow something to go in, that's because countries say, this isn't a bad idea. Let's keep talking. And talking is good. Talking means we're not shooting. Talking means we're not sending missiles. Talking means we're figuring out a way. Talking is good. Win-win solutions are good. Like the Iran deal. The Iran deal is a win-win solution. And unfortunately,
not according to the current administration.
I know, because they want to humiliate people. They think that a deal should be one is suppressed and the other is championed. But that's not how you do diplomacy.
Right.
And it's not a very good way to do business. You know, if I'm entering into a business agreement with somebody, we both want to profit from it. I don't want to humiliate my business partner.
I haven't
partner.
Read Art of the Deal, but I assume that's the theme of the book, yet it's not being played out in this regard with Iran.
Yeah, and I think that's unfortunate, because that was a win-win situation, and that's just pretty... It's not the best thing that deals with every single problem, but it's kind of hard to find a one solution fits all type of thing. So I'm a big fan of the Iran deal, also because it's the most intrusive inspections that have ever been created. And there's a massive global attention to make sure Iran's not going to get nuclear weapons. And that's really good for everybody. And if we think Iran shouldn't have nuclear weapons, why is it okay for us to have them?
Good points. 9:18 is the time. You're listening to Connections. I'm Roger Wendell. My guest in studio is Susie Snyder. She coordinates the global Don't Bank on the Bomb Research and Campaign Project. Got a note here from a listener online. Could you please announce that the March for Science is tomorrow, April 14th? So I'll do that. The March for Science is tomorrow, April 14th. I apologize. I don't have the time and location. I know it's in Denver in the morning. So Google that and join in on the March for Science. Let's go back to the phones, because Lois has been waiting a very long time. Lois, good morning. You're on Connections.
Good morning. Good morning. Thanks for focusing on this issue this morning. Something we should be aware of all the time. And I really appreciate the work that Susie Snyder and her group is doing. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Go ahead.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yep.
So forgive me if you've already dealt with this issue, because I turned in a little bit late. But I've been aware lately of a group called nuclearban.us, I guess that's their website, and that they have a plan. Or first of all, I should say that in recognition that we just can't sit and wait for our federal government to approve of or adopt the UN treaty to ban nuclear weapons, that we need to be taking action at other levels, just like with climate change, that we can't wait for our federal government to get back into the Paris Agreement, that we all need to be working on this issue at whatever level is appropriate. So this group, nuclearban.us, they have a plan to engage citizens and municipalities and faith communities and companies, both small and large, to all get themselves in compliance with the UN treaty to ban nuclear weapons by doing all kinds of activities that, you know, individuals or faith communities or cities can actually do. And I think it's just a really creative way of empowering all of us at all these different levels where we live our lives to emphasize the importance of nuclear weapons and getting rid of them. So I'd just love to hear your speaker talk a little bit more about that.
Thank you, Lois.
Yeah, thanks, Lois. Thanks for bringing that up. The folks at nuclearban.us, it's a great group of people. They're primarily on the East Coast, but they're picking up support all over the country. And they're building on some successes that we've had dealing with nuclear weapons across the U.S. in the past. So if you're old enough to remember the Sane Freeze movement in the 80s that got nuclear weapon free zones designated throughout municipalities across the United States. They're building on that model, and as you said so eloquently, when politicians at the federal level don't respond, then we bring it local, and we act locally. So they had some great success recently in Tacoma Park, Maryland. The city council passed a resolution declaring itself in compliance with the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. So Tacoma Park spearheading the way. Great going, Tacoma Park. In Cambridge, Massachusetts, about 2 years ago now, the city council passed a resolution saying it would divest all of the city's pension funds from companies associated with the production of nuclear weapons. And that's a great activity that the mayor, Denise Simmons, in Cambridge, Mass., really helped push through. And just recently, on the 10th of April, in Ojai, California, which I understand I've never been there, but I hear it's not the biggest community, but it doesn't matter because everything we do matters. Everything helps. And Ojai, California became the nation's newest nuclear weapon-free zone and has the most beautiful bit of city council resolution that talks about the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. It talks about divestment. It talks about how to keep citizens safe. And it also talks about new signage. When you enter the city of Ojai, there's going to be a nice new sign that's put up at the city limits saying it is clearly a nuclear weapon free zone. Now, this is something the city of Berkeley, California, these are somewhat progressive cities. The city of Berkeley, right. California, has also, in their nuclear weapon free zone, they have an agreement not to engage any contractors from the city for any work within the city that have contracts that relate to the production of nuclear weapons. And this has historically caused a couple of pretty big scandals for the city. Like at one time, they were worried about connecting with 3M because 3M was producing, you know, something that was indirectly connected to a nuclear missile. And it was several steps away from, you know, 3M didn't make nuclear bombs. Just want to make that clear. Please, no one from 3M get angry with me.
Okay.
I'm not alleging that they did that. But there was an indirect connection several steps away. And so there's a huge discussion. And those discussions make a difference. So thank you very much, Lois, for recognizing this. Nuclear ban is the way to be.
Thank you, Lois.
Great. You're welcome. Thank you both.
Okay, great. Again, you're listening to Connections. And my guest this morning is Susie Snyder, and we're talking about nuclear weapons. And Susie and Lois, too, you both kind of touched on briefly the companies that are involved in this. And this is a big part of your website. So tell us more about the companies who manufacture nuclear weapons and what we can do about that. And again, it's not 3M, it's some other companies.
Yes. So you look at companies, some that you'd expect. And it's important for people to know, especially here in the U.S., the U.S. government doesn't make the nuclear bombs themselves. They hire external contractors, government contractors. And the U.S. is one of the most transparent in publishing information about those contracts. So, you know, I do want to recognize that. So they hire contractors, for example, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, Boeing, to produce the missiles or components for the warheads that make nuclear weapons, nuclear weapons. And what we do with our Don't Bank on the Bomb project is we make that information public. And we encourage financial institutions not to invest. And financial institutions, I mean banks and pension funds, asset managers, and those such, not to invest in these companies. Because Boeing can't get a project like this going without committing resources to research and development and so on. And they need external financing to make that happen. So we say, let's cut off the flow of money. Let's stop the external financing. Now, Lockheed Martin is one of the, you know, they describe themselves as the world's largest arms manufacturer. You know, I'm sure everybody and all of your listeners know the details of Lockheed Martin. We have a sister project that does the same effort on cluster munitions. The United States did not sign the treaty that makes cluster munitions illegal. So within the U.S., it's not illegal to produce them. Lockheed Martin used to make them. But all these banks, all these pension funds said they were not going to invest in Lockheed Martin. There was a run on shares because of their production with cluster munitions. Lockheed Martin got a little bit upset, found out why, because the banks and pension funds said, we're not investing in you because you do this. And Lockheed Martin said, oh, well, we're going to stop. And they stopped producing cluster bombs. That's pretty cool. And that was just the power of the purse.
Right.
And so we figure, you know, let's do the same with nuclear weapons. In 1979, there was a big campaign across the U.S. to boycott General Electric, because General Electric was involved in producing components for the U.S. nuclear arsenal at the time. And it was boycott, and it was divestment, and General Electric said, okay, we're not going to do this anymore. It worked. Money matters. So with Don't Bank on the Bomb, we don't want to stop people from making money. You know, go ahead, make money. We want people to have a good pension fund. We just want you to build your pension, to build your investments on things that support a society that you want to grow old in, that you want to live in. And that is not a society that relies on nuclear weapons. So you can find out more information, don'tbankonthebomb.com. And you can also get tips and tricks. And I'll tell you, the easiest thing to do, just walk into the bank. Just, you know, just go do it today. Just pop into the bank, ask the bank manager or the teller or anyone, hey, do you have a policy that prevents the investment of in nuclear weapons? If they don't know, ask them to get back to you and find out. That is a great first step. And asking questions makes change. So I encourage your listeners to do so.
Encouraging indeed. But it makes me think also of Russia, China, Pakistan, Israel. Can something similar be done there, or especially even from here? Can I pressure the Russian government to reduce their arsenal, to quit funding companies that manufacture these things?
Unfortunately, the Russian Duma passed a law in January making that information classified. Now there is no information about the companies involved in Russia. And also none of them are traded on the public market, because we did have some information about companies involved, but they're not on the market. So it's actually quite a bit harder. So this is a tactic that works to stimulate the conversation, to build the stigma. And I'll tell you, the more that nuclear weapons are unacceptable and the more that we look at them as something that's disgusting and horrible and something to be ashamed of, that's going to bring everybody on board. And it's not just here. It will bring everybody in the world on board.
We don't have much time left. Tell me how optimistic you are. In your lifetime, my lifetime, maybe the lifetime of my children, are we going to see a marked change?
We have a choice. We can choose the end of nuclear weapons or the end of life as we know it, the end of us. And me, all my friends, hopefully you and all your friends, will just do a tiny little thing. It doesn't take much, and we can get the end of nuclear weapons. And I'm confident we will get the end of nuclear weapons in my lifetime. And I hope that's within your lifetime, too.
Very good. I hope so as well. Finally, contact information, website. What's the best way for folks to learn more about your work?
Go to nuclearban.org and sign up, and you'll get information about what we're doing. Connect with us. Find out about cool actions going on in your area. Nuclearban.org.
Fantastic. Susie Snyder, thank you so much for showing up at KGNU.
Thanks so much, Roger.
Okay, great having you. My guest has been Susie Snyder. She's the coordinator of the Global Don't Bank on the Bomb Research and Campaign. And you've been listening to Connections. I'm Roger Wendell. I want to thank Nancy for so ably handling the phones, as she often does every Friday morning. I want to thank you, our loyal listeners and supporters there for KGNU Denver, KGNU Boulder. Up next is the Morning Sound Alternative with none other than Meredith Carson. Have a great day.
Day after day, I'm more confused. Yet I look for the light through the pouring rain.